Welcome to the One Fall Podcast. I'm Joel Johnson, and we have a very special episode featuring me and Mo talking about the G1 climax and a little bit on Ric Flair. This podcast is a little bit older than originally intended. Life happens and things get busy. So just wanted to give you a quick update that we know Flair is all right and recovering. This was recorded the week of the event of happening with Flair in the hospital. So we're going to keep rolling with the episode as is because we talk a lot about the G1. I think it's really good. So without further ado, here it is. Welcome to the One Fall Podcast, minus Joshua Arbuthnot, who could not make it for this, but we have Mo in his place. I can't do as nice of an introduction for you, but...
The Crown Prince of Charisma.
There we go.
Crown Prince of Charisma, and you're supposed to say, hey, what it is, what it was. So you're saying Josh isn't here?
No, not at all. It's just you and me today. I don't think we've ever done this.
Just you and me, huh?
Yeah, so we'll see how this goes. See what this happens, but I think the biggest thing.
I never thought I'd long for Josh.
I know, it's kind of scary. I'm feeling the same way too. So.
Let's look at the positives. Josh is in here.
There you go. See, and in a wacky world of pro wrestling that has Ric Flair and not a great situation. I guess we could quickly touch on that. Just the
and whatever you want to touch on. I know we're here to largely talk to G1 because I saw it all, and I know you did, and watched a lot of it. But yeah, I mean, whatever you want to hit.
Yeah, I think the Flair thing has definitely taken a big spotlight, and you know, just when it broke on Monday this week, as we record this, it almost sounded like he was on his deathbed. It sounded like things were very grim, and when Meltzer's sending out certain tweets and certain guys are sending out certain tweets, it doesn't sound good. And now, mind you, he's still in critical condition, had part of his bowel removed because he had a blockage there. His kidneys are on dialysis, and he has other organ issues, and he has an infection. So, 68-year-old who did a lot of drugs, did a lot of drinking, still does a lot of drinking, partied extremely hard, airplane crash, struck by lightning twice. I didn't know about that until the middle of this week, so that was a fun little tidbit about Flair. And the guy went through 4 divorces that bankrupt him. That's why he still has to keep going on the road. And losing
plus
his son.
That plus he spent a lot himself.
Yeah, and he spent it on his gimmick. You go back, and I was watching old Flair promos, and he had those Rolex watches, he had all the nice clothes, and I guarantee you the promoter wasn't like, oh, whatever you want, Flair, we'll buy it for you. He lived the gimmick, and I think that's kind of all of that.
It was more than a gimmick. Ric Flair, he's a very interesting guy, but Ric Flair, the original, Richard Flair, certainly at some point I think it's fair to say he didn't know where Richard Flair started and Ric Flair began.
Yeah.
You know, like, ended or started or what? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like there was that point where it's like some guys live the gimmick and then there's Flair. It wasn't a gimmick. It was him.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you know what? Thinking about it, he's definitely Ric Flair through and through. I don't, like, you look at Hulk Hogan saying that there's 2 people, Hulk Hogan and Terry.
There isn't.
No.
I remember Bret Hart saying that like 15 years ago, that when he got down to WCW, he went down there on a weekend and he was staying at Hulk's house and nobody was around but him, and he didn't know how to not be Hulk. He had lost that too.
Yeah.
Of where Terry Bollea begins and where Hulk Hogan ends or whatever, you know, like he had also lost that. And that's a danger for a lot of guys.
Yeah. You get so immersed in these gimmicks, and I mean, Flair's given us a lot of memories. Like when everything kind of broke with Flair, one of the things that I saw pop up, and it's one of those enjoyable things that I can watch, is him versus Jay Lethal, the promo battles where Jay Lethal's doing the impression. And like, this guy is so influential in the, on just pro wrestling as a whole. His matches with Ricky the Steamboat, that trilogy is legendary. He traveled up
Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, not Ricky the Steamboat.
Oh,
I'm oops. Like, if he could, if he probably could have gotten a good match out of Ricky the Steamboat too.
Yeah, he very well could have. I mean, he's the one that Bret Hart beat for his first title in Saskatoon. The guy still in 2005, 2006 was blading any and every chance he got. I'll never forget his promo against Hunter where he's hitting his head and the blood's pouring and his hair's red and he's just fired up and ready to go. The guy that stripped his clothes off and told them that when they come back from a commercial break, his underwear is going to be gone and he's going to be strutting around naked. The guy that was on the plane ride from hell that was in his robe flashing stewardess. All this stuff. The legend of Ric Flair is massive. And I think that's the one thing you saw this week was that legend. And there's a lot of people that were genuinely sad to hear the state he's in. Because I think for a lot of people, that was their childhood hero.
Well, the thing about Ric Flair is that he gave us, definitely gave us a lot of incredible moments and entertained a lot of people. And at a cost to himself, and that's what he's experiencing right now.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the life he led for him was a lot of fun, and I don't think he would have not wanted to leave that life. I mean, basically what I'm saying is, and nobody says this, but it's true, Ric Flair was, was, like, just an incredibly high-functioning alcoholic.
Yeah.
Like, to the, you know, there's certain people that are alcoholics and they can't handle it. And he was beyond handling it. He was an incredibly high-functioning alcoholic, but that's what he was.
Yeah.
And it took, and you know, that led to him being Ric Flair and having that life and giving those moments. But it also, now, his body is paying the price for it.
Yeah.
And hopefully he does come out of it. But even if he does, I don't think Ric Flair knows how to not be Ric Flair.
Yeah.
And so it would be difficult because I don't think you can ever be Ric Flair the same way again.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You lose part of your intestines and you're now in, you've had, your kidneys have failed and you're on dialysis. Your body's not going to be the same. And, you know, I hope Flair can pull through and I hope that he can continue to carry on living because I think, a Ric Flair a world without Ric Flair is a very odd world. And
but I don't want it to be a sad end. I don't want him to be questioning what is his role and what is his function. What is he? You know, I don't want him sitting there not being able to be Ric Flair the way he wants to be it and searching for who he's supposed to be now, because that would also be sad.
Yeah.
So I hope that there's a happy compromise here and so everything can work out the way it's supposed to. But I mean, if you know, he's 68.
Yeah.
And if, you know how a dog, you know, my dog is like 12 years old, so she's actually 84.
Yeah.
Well, if every year of drinking was 7 years, this guy would be like 560. Like, you know?
He outlived so many people. We talk about guys that you're kind of surprised that are still alive in the wrestling business. And Flair has surpassed so many people. And, I mean, you said it best. He lived a full life.
Yeah.
Like, he lived the life of, like, three people with everything that he went through. At one point, it thought he could never return to wrestling because of the plane crash. And he kept going. And, like, I mean, he had that match with Michaels. That match, that final match, the sorry, I love you, the super kick, everything with that, you're just like, those are things that you're going to be like, he did it all. There's nothing that Flair didn't do in the business. And for the most part, he performed at a high level through most of his career.
And even after he's left it, and that was, you know, many years ago now, and obviously he had a run in TNA after and wrestled there and everything, and Australia against Hogan and all that stuff, you know, but unfortunately, instead of just letting the Michaels thing. But that's because he didn't know how to retire and not be. You know, even when he would come in and cut promos and do stuff, he would get physical in WWE even after the retirement at times, and they wouldn't want him to. But it's because he doesn't know how to not be that guy.
Yeah.
So that's the thing. I mean, you talk about living the life and whatever, but But even it's been hard for him to not be the Ric Flair of old for the last, you know, decade.
Yeah.
So can you imagine now? So but he's a fascinating character, and you know, a life filled of joy and tragedy, in many ways. But yeah, like you say, it's a completely full life.
Yeah, and I mean, he'd be in the ring, and I would be messaging Josh, and Josh would say Flair's gonna take a bump. Sure enough, retired Ric Flair would take a bump because, I mean, the guy just, like you said, it's, they're one and the same. It's like,
It bugged him that he couldn't do it anymore. WWE wouldn't let him do it anymore. It killed him. And it bugged him when people were saying, you can't do it anymore the way you used to. And to him, the fact that he was slowing down was tough.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was Ric Flair, goddammit.
Yeah. And, I mean, you look at Space Mountain. Everything about Flair, just you go back and you look at the merchandise and just his promos and everything. It's just, it's through and through Ric Flair. And if he pulls through and he's strutting down that ramp, I would not be shocked in the least if I saw him strutting down that ramp one last time. I don't know how much more he's got left in the tank, but only time will tell. And at the end of the day, he's one of those guys that I don't think there's a single regret in his life.
If the moment where he was to just, you know, in Atlanta or something like that, to come out at a Raw and just strut down the aisle one last time, the moment would be unbelievable. Those are the type of moments we watch wrestling for.
Yeah.
Like when in the G1 when Shibata came back, and this, you know, is even bigger. You know, like, yeah, those are the moments, right?
Oh yeah.
You watch for the great matches, but you remember the moments.
Yeah, I think
because you care.
I think that's the biggest thing with wrestling, and I think Kevin Owens had some sort of comment about it's about those moments. It's about building up to those moments, because as a fan, those are, like, I think this year, as much as I have loved what Kenny and Okada have done, and Tanahashi and Naito and Shibata and all those guys in Japan, I think one of the things that stand out for me this year that I still go back and watch is when Braun threw Roman, well, the dummy Roman, off the entrance ramp. Just that whole thing. It's a moment. And it made Braun, and even Braun popping out of the ambulance and yelling Braun and walking down to the ring and saying, I'm not finished with you. Those are moments. And,
yeah,
you know, transitioning a little bit from Flair to more of the
when present. I talk about the Attitude Era, I very rarely talk about matches.
Yeah,
I talk about Rock promos and Austin promos and, you know, Angle in the milk truck. And those are the things you talk about. Moments. And like I say, when is a moment like a Shibata coming back or a Flair possibly coming back that are real, that aren't scripted like a Braun Strowman, is even more powerful.
Yeah, and I mean, you look at, like, when Flair was announced as the partner for Vince in the Attitude Era, and you see Vince pulling on his ear as he's trying to figure out what's going on, and Flair's wooing. It's just little things like that that you're like, I remember that. I remember watching that live, seeing that. And it's those moments are stuff that stick with you as a fan and just bring you back time after time. But I think both of us can generally wish the best for Flair and his family and just hope that, like you said, that there's a happy compromise for this tough situation, and hopefully
kick out Flair.
Yeah,
that's you know, that's
okay. I had messaged Josh and I said, you know what's going to happen with Flair? He's going to kick out at 2.5. He's going to jump out of the bed. He's going to woo. He'll probably chop someone, and then as he's strutting down the hallway naked, all the nurses will end up pregnant. And he will walk out of that hospital wooing his way back home. So
that would be very Ric Flair.
Yes, and that's very much the character and the person that Ric Flair is. He's cultivated that where a simple person in Ontario can be reading about this Flair stuff and thinking he's going to kick out, a bunch of nurses are going to end up pregnant, and he's probably going to chop someone. He may do a Flair bump at some point, and He'll be out of that hospital. That's what he's created for us.
Yeah, and exactly.
I think
that persona.
I think that's a really awesome gift to give people, is that you were able to create that. I know it came at a price, and he's paying it right now, but I guess when you pay that price and you paid it for fans like you and I, all you can do is support the guy and wish his family well, respect the privacy, and just keep them in their thoughts and prayers.
Absolutely, no question.
Now, on to a little bit more of a light subject. It hurt. There were some table spots. Some necks are definitely bruised. Some torn biceps are definitely worse off than what they were. But, Mo, did we just witness the best G1 in years?
Every G1 is incredible. This is the best one I've seen. I've been watching them now. This is only my fourth one I've watched live or followed live, and I've gone back and watched highlight matches of some other ones. But this is the best. And it's funny because a lot of people were saying that this, you know, they weren't so sure about this one because they weren't bringing any outside talent. They were, you know, like last year they brought in a couple people from NOAH. You know, and that type of thing. There's all people on the roster, but I really looked at the blocks and thought, oh, both blocks are just kind of great nights. And there wasn't a single night, every single night, and it's incredible, where you didn't get at least one 4-star-plus match, and often more than one, and often far more than 4 stars.
Yeah.
Like, it was unreal.
I kind of cherry-picked what I did watch and what I didn't watch. I would kind of find what I was really into. But just the atmosphere and just going on the Squared Circle Reddit and just reading people's thoughts. Because there's certain shows that I would catch bits and pieces of. But reading just the excitement for a Juice Robinson match or Evil. Both names that you know, but now have grown. And I mean, other guys like Tama Tonga, who now have taken on a bigger persona. And thanks to the G1, plus the storyline with the Bullet Club, has gained some life. And I mean, a guy like Evil is now, in most eyes, a certified main eventer now.
Yeah, he's going to get a main event shot. And, you know, he's earned it. Which is crazy, because, you know, you watch him just, you know, a couple years ago as Watanabe in ROH when he's on Excursion, and you thought, yeah, good, maybe he'll be a good mid-carder.
Yeah.
And then he came in and got this gimmick, and you're like, yeah, that's a pretty good gimmick. Maybe he'll do a little better with it. But now he's better still. And he had a lot of really good matches, but also, like you say, it's the persona. But it's everything. Like, do they have the best wrestlers in the world in New Japan Pro Wrestling? Yes. A lot of that, though, is because those people are allowed to be the best wrestlers in the world. Like, you know, they let them have the great matches that the other companies don't always let them have. But and if there's a negative to this G1 for me, it's that there was so many great matches that not enough sticks out. Not enough. I can't just sit there and start listing all of them because they start to blend together at some point.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think that's like that. I've got the card up for the last 3 days because those are the freshest in our minds. But I mean, you start from night one all the way working down, like Omega versus Elgin.
Was great. Night one had I believe Naito and Ibushi.
Yep.
And that was one. That was for a while, a long time. That was my favorite. Match of the whole tournament. And then but I mean, like you say, I mean, you just got great match, like over and over, to the point where it's almost overkill.
Yeah.
To the point where it's almost like you're watching this and you're remembering it. You're sitting there saying, I just watched the greatest G1 in history. But 5 years from now, will you remember this G1 more than other ones? You'll remember it was great. But what will you remember? And I do think that luckily some of those things in those final few nights helped.
Yeah.
They have the best wrestling, but also they have the best booking. And that they know how to keep people strong. So even mid-carders aren't buried, you know?
And that's the thing that, you know, I think WWE can definitely, you know, take a look at and go, well, shit, we could probably do that. We can probably have smart, simple booking. Because a lot of it is just simple, logical booking. Like, I mean, you look at there were certain guys that didn't win a lot, but they weren't supposed to win a lot. But you've got some of the old vets. I'm going to butcher his name, Nagata,
yeah.
Like, this was his last G1. That was a storyline you had. Ibushi returning.
It was so great. I mean, he had so many great matches. So that when it's over, even though he only won the one match against Zack Sabre Jr., and then he lost, you know, to Zack Sabre Jr. In a tag match on the right at the end. So almost that was almost taken away. And yet it wasn't, because you're like, Because you see this guy who's in his last G1 fighting so hard to win, so you're cheering for him so bad, even though, and so every time he loses, it doesn't make you think, oh, he sucks, like it does in WWE stuff usually when you see somebody lose. Instead, you sit there going, God, he's trying so hard. I really want him to win the next one.
Yeah.
So you actually care more about him. Like I say, that's about the good booking. I mean, that's the thing. Make no doubt about it. Like I say, right now, the best wrestlers in the world, AJ Styles in the WWE is the only guy and he hasn't had nearly as good a year as last year.
Yeah.
He's the only guy, though, that you're sitting there going, yeah, he's at the level of guys like Okada and Omega and, you know, Naito and Tanahashi and Ishii and the Young Bucks and Kushida. Like, all these guys are at a certain level where they are the, to use the term, elite. And then you go, and AJ Styles is there. And then you go, and who else? And you know that guys like Nakamura has been in the past, and Finn Balor, and a guy like Rollins has that potential, Cesaro. And there's guys that are like that, but they're not given that chance.
Yeah.
They only can go so far, be seen as so good when they're in the WWE. And make no doubt about it, because the everything comes down to the booking. It's not that the talent is better. I mean, it is, because they're elite right now, and they're having those great matches. But if you took the top 30 guys from the WWE and transported them over to New Japan and gave the top 30 guys from Japan, I guarantee you the Japan product would still be the better product.
Yep.
Because the booking and the way they let them do it is so much better.
Yep, I absolutely agree. I think, and you look at, like, I guess you could say that this G1 was a little bit, I feel it was slightly a little bit more predictable, at least for me. I had a very strong inclination that Naito was going to win.
And he did. I use my pick too. I think most people's.
And he had a strong inclination that Omega was going to do very well. And especially when you knew that the last match in the block with featuring Omega and Okada, they were going to be the last two to face off against each other. You're kind of like, it kind of makes sense for Omega to finally get the win over a very tired and beaten up Okada. Then yeah, go on
they telegraphed it. They telegraphed it, but it didn't matter that they showed their hand, because it didn't make you say, "Oh, I know what's going to happen." It made you say, "Oh, I can't wait till we get there, and I hope we have a great journey on the way." And we did.
Oh yeah, and I guess there's a couple names that I want to get your take on. What do you think of what you saw from Zack Sabre Jr., who's almost being positioned to what it seems like to being positioned a guy to take the Intercontinental title off Tanahashi?
I don't know if he will take it off him or not, but no matter what, he's in a good place. It's really interesting. They booked him really smartly again, right? He ended up going 5-4, and yet he got wins. He got big wins, and his losses, he was made to look strong too. He's a guy who I don't – like, he's a guy that to me is – like, you talk about those guys that I mentioned that are the elite, and he's one level down.
Yeah.
But he can get to there, and when he's one level down, and that's your next level, is guys who are that good, just shows you how deep the company is.
Yeah.
I think he was really good. I think the biggest thing for him is he was still sort of unknown and still seen as a guy who had been in Noah and DDT and these things as a lightweight.
Yeah.
And when this is over, everybody sees him as a legit heavyweight who's dangerous.
Yeah.
You know? Because the way, like, he submitted Ishii, just incredible submission.
Yeah.
Things like that make him seem so dangerous. And so yeah, and that's the thing about him. He's positioned like he's a legit threat now to people.
Oh, yeah. And that was the one thing that you take. You now, when he steps in the ring eventually with Tanahashi again, because he beat Tanahashi, so he will eventually get to challenge for that Intercontinental title. You're now nervous for Tanahashi, the former ace of New Japan. You're a little like, all right, bicep tear. He's really
going as the favorite, wouldn't he?
Yeah. And that's crazy to think that they were able to do that, and they were able to do it for G1 for a guy that finished kind of in the middle of the pack.
A guy who finished in the middle of the pack is seen as a legit, and this is Tanahashi, for those people who are not familiar with him, the best way to put it is he's New Japan's, he's currently their Intercontinental Champion, but he's New Japan's John Cena of the last 15 years or so. Like, he is that guy. So that this guy who is, you know, this 200-pound submission specialist who's fairly new to this company is now seen as, it goes 5-4 and yet is seen as a legit threat to beat him because of how the story is told. Again, and the other thing is they tell stories and yet they don't do it with backstage vignettes and all that stuff. I mean, sometimes there's a little bit of that. There's usually a post-match interview and but the storytelling, it comes from the angles in the ring, the matches in the ring, the angles of brawls and stuff like that after, the matches in the ring, and the announcers getting over the stories.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's so fresh because when you watch Raw and it's 3 hours and 10 minutes and there's literally 40 minutes of wrestling, like, how much can that entertain you? I mean, we talk about the moments, but there was moments in this too. Excuse me, I had to cough there.
Yeah.
There's moments in this too, but again, they're told in a different way.
Yeah. Oh, and I absolutely agree. Like, having a simple match, like, it was smart to have Ibushi versus Sabre Jr. because that was a long rumored Cruiserweight Classic final. And they're like, well, we can give it to you guys now, and you can tell a story within the ring. And Sabre had a whole storyline going throughout this tournament. And now you've built up a legitimate heavyweight that can now, he could step in the ring.
The idea is his skill level is so bloody high, he can beat anybody.
Yeah, you believe that he could beat an Okada, Omega, an Ishii, a Naito.
Because he could catch them.
Yeah, and that's all it takes. And that's the thing that New Japan has captured, is that sports element and that realism of, at any point, someone could win.
And there's no doubt that there's a lot of entertainment going on. And there's a lot of gimmicks. And there's a lot, you know, you got your Yanos, or just you got the different things. Like, so, I mean, you talk, it's a sports thing. But it's presented like, it's not so much like it's presented like a sport to me. It's that it's presented like it's serious and important. So even when comedy's happening, you, like a guy like Yano, he wins, what, 3 matches? I think he went 3-6.
Yeah, I think so.
And his finishing move is a low blow, you know, that he gets in when the referee isn't looking. And yet, he got 3 wins. So even though he's not very good, he can actually beat anybody.
Yeah.
So even though it's a comedy match, you know, and he's a comedy character, it's important enough, and the wins and losses are important enough, that you pay attention during his matches. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we'll probably talk about maybe him and Omega a little bit later, but, you know, because that was pretty controversial. But, yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, like you said, so to me, it's not even so much a sports thing as an importance thing.
That's a very fair point. Like, that definitely helps because, I mean, when you look at WWE, and that's our biggest comparison to it. You look at New Japan and then you look at WWE and you kind of look back and forth at these and you look at the just some like it sucks that there's a lot of things that you see that should be considered important aren't. Like, I guess the most important match in SummerSlam, and I think the one that I'm most intrigued by, I have an idea how it's going to play out already, but is the Lesnar Fatal 4-Way match that's been treated probably the most serious on that card. I think Lesnar's walking away with the title. No,
I think that the stipulation that if he doesn't walk or doesn't win, he's walking away has worked on the opposite. Instead of making intrigue and people and building off the UFC, it's done the opposite. It's made people go, oh, so he's winning because he's not going anywhere. Nobody believes he's going anywhere.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's actually, instead of helped, it's hurt. It's a weird thing, despite the great efforts of Paul Heyman on the mic. I look at that tag title match between The Shield and Cesaro and Sheamus. I'm like, those are the two best storylines. I know exactly where they're both going.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, because I know Lesnar's winning and it's a four-way, I'm sure that match will be excellent.
Yep.
But I really can't. I don't care.
Yeah.
And I don't care who wins. And I don't care if Lesnar. At the end of the day, it's like, yeah, nothing's going to change.
Yeah.
Like, everything's going to be the exact same. Nothing changes because nothing feels important enough. So even though the match will probably be terrific, it's like, yeah, but what's going to be different in a month? Probably nothing.
Yeah.
And whereas things actually feel like they can be different in New Japan at any time.
Yeah, and I mean, another guy I really wanted to talk about was Ibushi. Because he was one of the last guys revealed for the G1. It got a big reaction when it was revealed to the live audience. How did he do, and what do you think the future is for him in New Japan? Because he's been a guy that's been very elusive, and he's still very much keeping the mindset of a freelancer. Do you think he finally settles down with New Japan, or is he just going to keep kind of doing his Ibushi thing involving fireworks and weird matches in DDT that are entertaining?
Yeah, he's always been, even when he was there and was a junior champion and in past G1s, he's always performed elsewhere. And you know what? I don't know that changes. That's probably who he is. But, I mean, will he be at the Tokyo Dome? Yes. And who's he going to take on? Omega. And it's going to be fucking incredible.
That's it.
Like, I don't care if they give me another match. And the whole card. And I don't care that I have to wait that long. I'm going to get that. And if, I know the whole event will be incredible. That alone right there is worth anticipating New Japan over the next, 4 months.
Oh, yeah. Quick little tidbit.
I just want to say, Ibushi was my actual MVP of the tournament. I mean, a lot of people have different MVPs, and there's a lot of guys who deserve, and certainly of his block. But for me, not only did he have incredible matches, but he had really different matches that were incredible.
You know? I've got to give it to the current ace, Okada.
Just great.
Just can't. He's on another level this year. I didn't think he'd get on another level. He was amazing last year, but the level that he's on now is just downright scary.
He is no question the best guy in the world.
Oh, yeah.
No question about that. I mean, it's just, it's not even, there's no argument to be made.
I always try to make a case for Omega, but just what Okada does, it's hard to argue against that.
Omega's had like 5 great matches, but 2 of them have been against Okada. Whereas Okada's had like 12 great matches.
Yeah.
You know, 2 of them have been against Omega, or 3 against Omega now, I guess.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? It's like, it's just a volume of great matches that's, like, even in this tournament, I think he had more great matches than Omega.
Yeah. No.
For instance, his match with Yano.
Yeah.
Was super exciting because he actually made you think Yano could beat him.
Yeah.
You know?
That's the thing that, and it goes back to that philosophy on booking that they did through this whole G1. They made that, you actually were invested and you were like, is Yano, holy shit, Yano, wow. Like, just completely catch you off guard and you're like, crap. All right, they went there. They didn't, obviously, but you're still like, you're hooked in. And
yes, exactly.
I guess a quick little tidbit, because I think Omega and Ibushi have been one of the best ongoing feuds in wrestling right now. I think they've got that storyline kind of locked down. But a funny little tidbit that I'd heard was when...
Omega and Ibushi?
Omega and Ibushi. Did I say Okada?
No, you said Omega. I was wondering if you meant Okada.
No, it was Ibushi and Omega.
Yeah, they started in DDT having great matches and everything.
And that's one of the reasons why I go to it. It's one of the best storylines, is how long it's been going on. But a note that I learned this week, when AJ faced Ibushi for the title and Omega was out there to distract, that was all done by AJ. AJ only wanted Omega out there, and he knew why he wanted just Omega out there. He didn't want any other Bullet Club stooges, and he wanted Omega to be involved in the finish because he knew that storyline, and it just was that little thing that built up to it. And I mean, you look at Omega not taking any questions on Ibushi and being very like, if we face each other again, someone's probably going to die. And if you've actually seen their one match that they've had, it's just like, yeah, someone's probably going to die in the Tokyo Dome, so that's cool.
And you know what? Yeah, I didn't know that. That's super cool about AJ. I do know this, that Dave Meltzer had an interview with Omega. This is probably last, you know, January, when it was, hey, is Omega going to stick around any longer, blah, 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 after the Tokyo Dome. And when he came back and he said he re-signed with them, he said one of the reasons he did was because a good friend of his, a really good friend with his, that he was wanted to have a match with in New Japan for a really long time, had a chance to sign with them and didn't. And I was trying to figure out who that was, because there was a ton of people that could have been.
Yeah.
You know, it could have been Tama Tonga, you know, but it was Ibushi.
Yeah.
He, you know, this is all coming together. They had, at the end of the final night, they had a backstage run-in, and it's just, it's good. And that's the thing, that's, I mean, I don't think Omega's going anywhere ever, but not only because of the type of matches, but because of the creativity that they're, the freedom they're given as people to help put together their matches and how they get there, that, you know, obviously you don't get in WWE. And I'm not trying to sit here and slam WWE and we're gushing over this. You just got to understand, it was great. It's not perfect.
No.
But it was great. Like, it's over and you're like, that was great. Every night was great. It's just, if you want to watch pro wrestling, this is what you should be watching.
Yeah.
If you want to watch entertainment, you should watch a lot of other things, and maybe catch the one or two good entertaining segments on Raw every week, because usually there's one or two really good entertainment segments that are awesome. But it's a 3-hour show, and that hurts.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that definitely hurts. And, I mean, you look at the G1, most shows were, what, 3 hours?
Yeah, but it was 3 hours of different storylines of all. There's so much character development within matches.
Yeah.
And they're, even like the Young Lions, you know, they have all these guys who you're seeing them develop at different paces, who are there, who are going through their dojo and develop their personalities and their move sets and all this stuff. And they set up stuff with them for feuds for like 2 years down the road from actions that happen after matches, you know, where they get attacked by like a Suzuki and how about that Suzuki and Okada match, by the way?
Oh
my God.
Time limit. And that's the other thing that you're like, Okada just can't, like, I guess if you're going to talk about a negative with New Japan, the style can definitely be physically draining on these guys.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm surprised Okada's not just basically a walking, talking roll of duct tape. But
the thing is, they hit each other extremely hard, but there's ways to hit each other extremely hard in safe places. And they are good at that.
Yes.
So that it does look a little worse than it actually is.
Yeah, and that's the thing that. Like,
but that match, that match though was hitting each other really hard, really, really hard, and not always in a safe place. Like if you're slapping somebody really, really hard and it's a real slap, that could still cause a concussion.
Yeah.
But my favorite match this year is still the first Omega Suzuki match. That was just unbelievable. Suzuki just torturing his leg for like 40 minutes. It was just incredible psychology. And at the first 15 minutes of this, because I had heard that it was like, oh, people are saying, oh, you know, it's even better. First 15 minutes of that one, I'm like, oh, this is nowhere near as good. That last 15 minutes is like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Like, that's pro wrestling on a whole other level.
I mean, I think the 30-minute time limit helped all these matches. Because,
for sure.
Like, I really, really, really liked Omega versus Okada. I don't think it's the best one of the trilogy that they put on.
The second one, that hour-long time limit draw, is the best match of the year.
The fact that that was an hour and it didn't feel like an hour just speaks volumes to that match. But this half hour, the pace is quick and fury, and you can see that the psychology that's built from the previous two matches are all instilled in this one match that's 30 minutes, and the only way Omega can defend his G1 title from last year is to beat Okada, a guy he's not beaten yet, and God, they protected that one wing angel.
Well, he was
so
beaten once by Evil.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean. I know exactly what you're saying, that he had never beat him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there, that was the other storyline with Okada. It was like, could he go undefeated up to Omega? Like, were they going to pull the trigger on that? And that was another fun thing to watch. Just like, is Okada going to remain undefeated?
I thought they were both going to remain undefeated when the third thing started. I thought they both finished 9-0 because it was a new storyline. It was pretty close, though.
Yeah. And what do you think of Juice getting a win over Omega?
Oh, it was so good. My favorite part maybe is he wins, and first thing, and he turns around and he goes, "Holy fuck!"
Oh, it's
because Juice Robinson. People don't know this about CJ Parker, but in the backstage when he cuts a promo, if it's a 5-minute promo, it has the F word like 40 times. Like he just peppers everything.
Oh, it's great.
It's hilarious, and because you're allowed to. New Japan's not for kids, but as Rocky Romero kept saying, I love Rocky. By the way, the 3-man booth, thought he was great.
Kevin Kelly just shines so bright in this when they had English commentary.
Think about how good he is here.
Yeah, and that's the thing that you're like, he's just putting over so many little things, and he's that gatekeeper of knowledge for English speaking fans.
He's what a announcer should be.
Yeah,
he is the voice of the fans. So he's informing you, but he's also asking the questions to the other guys that you want to hear.
Yeah.
So he's the voice of the fan, and you relate to him, and he's likable.
Yeah.
And these are the things that obviously WWE has really missed since getting rid of JR.
Yeah.
You know, those qualities. And even Kevin Kelly didn't have them at first. He's had to grow into it. But he said I like that Don Callis, Cyrus Theory, like, the last night when Juice Robinson wins another match in the tag team match, and he goes, you know, this kid's got to stop acting surprised every time he wins a big match. But even that's part of the storyline, right? Because now the characters, like, all of a sudden, Juice Robinson, like I say, CJ Parker. Let me tell you my personal experience with CJ Parker, right? Like, we see him in the early NXTs, and he's just a job guy.
Yeah.
Then he gets that gimmick, that hippie gimmick, and he comes out, and he's getting a little bit of a push. And somehow he's young. He's like 23, 24, and he seems really small, even though he's not. And he's super annoying. He's trying too hard. He's forcing a character. And so everybody boos him. So he's about babyface that gets booed. So now I'm like, oh, well, they got something with him as a heel, though. Just keep this up. So they turn him heel, and instead of letting him do all the stuff that he was doing that was getting him booed as a babyface, they make him like come to the ring with a sign saying that we need to recycle, and he's no longer doing this stuff that made people hate him.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, instead of hating him, you don't hate him. Now he's just some bad guy wrestler that wasn't that good before, and so people stop caring. And I'm like, when you have why change? What's getting him the heat?
Yeah.
This is something WWE consistently does. When somebody's getting over as a heel turned to babyface, instead of letting him continue what he was doing as a heel, they change his character completely as a babyface, and vice versa. If a guy is a babyface getting booed, instead of letting him continue to do those things and now just make him babyface, they completely change it. And think about a time that they didn't change it, and it worked in NXT with Bo Dallas, when he was supposed to be a babyface and people booed him, and they let him continue to be that kind of trying too hard babyface who seemed phony, and it worked. And then they fucked it up on the main roster. But the point being, like, so you watch this guy. Now he's nothing. Now he's just got this stupid gimmick. They didn't do any of the stuff that lets him get any heat. And I'm realizing towards the end, I'm like, man, if they just let him do that. And then I'm realizing how big he is, and he's filling out, he's getting bigger. And I'm like, man, if they just repackage him and try again. And instead he says he's leaving, and he says CJ Parker's retiring, which he was, because CJ Parker wrestled like 3 matches as CJ Parker on the independents, and then he became Juice Robinson, and you're like, oh, and then you find out Matt Bloom, A-Train, because he wrestled there in New Japan, got him that job because he wanted to. And he goes in as the – I'm sorry if I'm talking too much, Joel.
No worries. Keep going.
But he goes in, and he's already been trained, and he's already fairly experienced, and he's willing to accept being a young lion and going to the dojo. And those guys have to do a lot of horrible shit. A lot of stuff like cleaning up after things, and a lot of stuff being just errand boys and taking care of, you know, anything and massaging and whatever they have to do for the veterans. All sorts of stuff to learn respect. That's part of the training is the learning of the respect of the business, and it's nasty. And it's hard, and they work them hard in that dojo. But he does it, despite no attitude. He goes through that, he comes through, he starts to develop a character, he starts to get over. He's gotten really good. Now at 28 years old, he was the youngest guy in this year's G1. And all of a sudden, this guy that WWE let go, that I don't think is ever coming back because he's having so much success and is going to continue to, feels like the best young wrestler in the entire world. Because he's got tons of charisma. And he knows the psychology of how to be a babyface perfectly to get over.
Yeah, and I like you say everything, and I don't sit here and go, "Well, Mo, actually, you're spot on with it." Like he's a guy.
That, yeah, you want that's why Josh needs to be here, so we have somebody who's consistently wrong.
Yeah, you see, that always helped make us look a little bit better. So that's what's lacking
that's
in this podcast
is somebody who just never is right about anything.
We miss that. We miss you, Josh. We miss your wrong answers. But
yeah,
you know
he's gonna listen to this, right?
Probably not. So
there you go.
It'll always float out there. Maybe one day in like 10 years he'll hear it and he'll have something to say. But it'll be 10 years away, so we won't have to worry.
Yeah, I can't wait. He'll have lots of time to come up with a comeback then.
Exactly. It'll be time to grow the heel promo that he wants to cut. But Juice Robinson, like you listen to the guy's promo. And the fact, like, him beating Omega means something, and it's a big deal. It doesn't matter that it was a roll-up. All that matters is he got the 1-2-3, and that's the big thing with New Japan, and they built off of it. If it was WWE, he got a fluky win. Will he be able to do it again? No, he won't. We've killed
him
all.
That's exactly it. He was, at the time that it happened, Omega was 6-2, and he was... Omega was 5-1. Sorry, Omega was 5-1, and he was 1-5. And I believe. Does that sound right?
I think so.
Yeah, he was 1-5. And he beat Omega. And then, you know, like I say, he does the whole surprise thing. And then he goes on and he wins his next match. I can't remember who that was against. But then he beat Elgin, who had an incredible tournament and had beaten Omega and had an unbelievable match with Okada. And is the strongest guy in New Japan Pro Wrestling. And then he beat him on the final night. So, like you say, they didn't drop the ball. They didn't let him get a big win and then make him lose the next week and the next week like they do WWE. Take Kalisto as a chance, as an example. They would let him win a match against, it doesn't matter if it's Braun Strowman or Alberto Del Rio. Then next week, instead of letting him win again, he would lose. And then, you know what I mean? So he would never get that momentum. No, when Juice finally got his win and starts to believe in himself, now he wins his next three matches. Yeah, he only finishes 4-5, but he won three in a row to end, and he has momentum, and he beat a mega star.
Yeah.
Again, comes down to, what do we talk about here?
Booking.
Good booking and storytelling.
And New Japan and Gedo has it down in spades. Now, we've got the last three nights, and the last three main events are big deals, all for different reasons. What do you think of Tanahashi versus Naito? We had a feeling that Naito was going to go over and win, but that match was really good, and it really created that tension of maybe the ace is going to go on to the finals. Maybe they're going to swerve us, but... They obviously went with Naito. What do you think of what they were able to do in that match?
Just incredible. I almost feel sorry for these guys because they've had three matches at like pretty much the exact same times that Okada and Omega have had three matches. And if Okada and Omega hadn't happened this year, we'd be talking about this as the greatest trilogy since Flair and Steamboat in '89. Instead, they're having to live up to these matches that are... So they go in and they have like 4.5, 4.75, and 4.5 star matches. And instead of people talking about how incredible they are, on the other hand, you have 4.75, 5, and 4.75, right?
Yeah.
So so it's almost forgotten.
Yeah.
We should really respect these guys for how good they are and how great these matches are. And go back and watch them again, like almost on like their own plane, and their own, separate them from Omega and Okada. Just watch them as a trilogy in their own universe. They're so damn good.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, Tanahashi's doing this with a torn bicep.
Yeah, but he's smart.
He's smart.
He uses it to his advantage instead of,
letting it hinder. And... That's the thing.
Native storyline.
He's using it to get more of a reaction from the crowd, and he's tweak the way he wrestles slightly to make it work for him.
Yep.
So he can keep going, keep performing at a high level. And man, I don't know if Tanahashi loses the title. I don't know if he's going to need surgery on his bicep, but you keep throwing out Tanahashi matches, I'm going to go and watch them. He's enjoyable to watch.
He's incredible. He really is. He is one of the all-time greats.
Oh yeah. And when you compare him to Cena, just what he meant for New Japan, I think that's the big thing is he is...
Cena, as far as what he meant for business, because the company was on a downward spiral until he got pushed to the main event. And Nakamura, too, is the other guy that really helped. He was their Randy Orton in some ways, but he was bigger than Orton. But Tanahashi wasn't as big as Cena, so it kind of evened out. But Tanahashi as a wrestler, of course, better than Cena, you know. Like that. When I say he's their Cena, I don't mean it that way.
Yeah.
As a wrestler, he's, like I say, closer to a Flair.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think that's...
Steamboat, you know, at that level.
Yeah. Here's something. I guess it's a little bit of a diversion from the three nights, but there was some controversy through this G1. It wasn't spotless. And I think the two things that you know I'm going to talk about is the evil and Omega... The possibility of evil being knocked out, and the Yano and Omega match. Omega was kind of surrounded by some controversy in the middle of this G1. What do you think? I've never gotten your take on both these subjects.
We haven't. We usually would message each other, and then we actually kind of fell silent during this whole thing. I was kind of wondering. I was like, maybe I should message him and find out what he's thinking. And then I thought, well, maybe we'll have a chance to talk about it down the road. So I'm glad I didn't. So which one do you want to talk about first?
Let's go with the Evil and Omega.
So the situation is, in that match, and for people who are unfamiliar, and I think probably if you're listening, you probably are familiar, but if you're unfamiliar, was that there's a spot in the match where Kenny Omega has a move called the V-Trigger, and he hits this move. It's a stiff knee, you know? And Omega, some people say he was knocked out. The people were worried about him being concussed. It was said that he got a stinger. Was what New Japan said, you know. But he appeared to be out on his feet. And Omega goes to pin him. And he puts his foot on the rope. Because the guy seems knocked out, so Omega's like, well, let's just end the match. This isn't the finish, but let's just end the match. The guy puts there's instinct, whether he was selling all the time. It's really tough to say, or selling to a degree, but... He puts his foot on the ropes, so Omega's like, well, okay, so I guess I better hit him with my finish, like I'm supposed to. But the guy seems dead on his feet, and he dead weights him. So Omega can barely get him up. Eventually gets him up, hits his move, and pins him after hitting another knee, and the guy doesn't fall down, and all this stuff is really weird. And they had been having this terrific match, and then all this sequence seems really out of place. So the emphasis is obviously not on Omega here, though. Omega tried to pin him. The emphasis is, he could have just pulled him to the middle and tried to pin him again, I suppose. But the emphasis here really is on the referee. I think it was Red Shoes.
Yes, it was. And that's the thing. And that was the thing. Excuse me. I'm maybe dying here.
Better you than me.
Yeah, see, exactly. That was one thing that I heard that people talked about the most. Like, Omega took a lot of heat and a lot of flack. But Cyrus, who does the podcast with Lance Storm, and he said he had it on good authority that Evil was not knocked out, and that was the situation. But the other thing that I think stands out most is you'd think someone like Red Shoes would have jumped in and checked on.
Veteran Evil. Referee. Veteran, you know, nearly 30 years, I think, as a ref.
Yep. But it... and.
But this is it, though. I think this is also partially, though. I mean, even him, I feel sorry. You're in that moment. You don't know what's going on. Should you jump in and stop it? Yes. Like when Chris Jericho hurt Neville and he's yelling at the referee, just stop it. He's fucking hurt, you know, on Raw. And that referee didn't know what to do either. Like, the thing is, these guys are so good at selling. He might not have known. Like, it's really tough for him. So it's just a bad situation. And, you know.
And that's
unfortunate.
It's an unfortunate situation. Evil seems to be fine. He was in the ring with Naito after the win. and he wrestled a match beforehand, so
then he got the win over Okada two nights later.
Yeah, so
in an incredible match. So
you know, none of us are in Kenny's shoes, Evil's shoes, or Red shoes, and that kind of works out really well.
That's perfectly done. I would love some of his shoes.
They're very nice, and he jumps very high in them. I wonder if the shoes play a role in them when he's really excited in the ring. But, I mean, these three guys, they had to do what they had to do in the ring, and we've never been in a wrestling ring, so we can't really judge them.
No, not in that way. I think it, to some degree, is probably blown a little out of proportion. Not is an unfortunate thing. Accidents happen in wrestling. When these things happen, it's difficult to always react perfectly. Let's move on.
Yeah, exactly. And let's move on to Omega and the other little bit of controversy, his one-star match from the G1. Yano, what did you think of a comedy match in the middle of G1? Dave Meltzer didn't seem to like it. Didn't seem like comedy belongs in the middle of the G1. But does it bring some levity to this long, grueling thing and really kind of almost give a guy a night off? Where he's not having to go for 25 minutes, almost killing himself.
You know what? I'm going to reverse this one. I'm going to ask your opinion first.
I have no issue with it. And I think the big thing is, this is a very grueling tournament. You get beat up in this tournament, and you've got injuries, and some guys are more banged up than others. I think having a match like this, though it's not going to give you that five-star classic, it's still going to give you some entertainment, and it's going to give you something that these guys can really almost take the night off in some regards of not killing themselves, still going out and performing at a high level, but I have no issues with it. I didn't get all the hullabaloo about it. It's just a night where these guys aren't killing themselves, so I think that's more important than having 9 straight matches where you're like, yep, his neck's broken, or yep, his shoulder's torn apart, yep, his knees are gone. I'd much rather have one match where it's like, it's not going to be 5 stars, but I'm going to get entertained out of this, I'm going to laugh, and Omega's going to win, and that'll be the end of it.
Okay. I'm a big fan of Yano. In fact, if you were to ask me my favorite wrestler, I'm not so sure I wouldn't say it's him. I love his act. I laugh at his act a lot. When he's having a match, I perk up. Sometimes, you know, even with the great stuff going on, it's a lot of wrestling you're watching. But when it's him, I usually perk up because I'm like, how is this going to go? How is a guy like this, who's this comedy guy, whose gimmick is he has no skill and cheats to win, but is lovable? How is he going to face a bad luck Fale or someone like that? Right? You know, just these different people. Because it just seems so odd. So I, and it's really good. The thing about it is, generally, there's extremely good psychology behind his matches.
Yeah.
You know, for doing this and doing that style. So I'm a big fan of Yano. And I do wish there was another Yano. I agree, because Yano is a night off.
Yeah.
You don't take anything physically. You don't do anything. It's too bad there can't be a Yano on both blocks.
Because
the A block had, the B block had him? Was that the B block? Yeah, that was the B block, right?
Yeah.
B block had him. A block could have used a guy like that too, because this is a brutal tournament. So having a guy like that, Takahashi is a little bit like that in the past. He wasn't in it this year, but he's Yujiro Tanahashi, because he just doesn't have he's not very physical.
Yeah.
But he's still not as light as Yano. So having a guy like that's great, you know? The guys deserve that. They need that extra night off in this grueling tournament. So I wish there was another one.
Yeah.
That said, this one went a little too far for me. Now, they actually faced each other. The reason I was super excited for this match is they faced each other in last year's G1. And nobody bitched about it. And in last year's G1, what happened? Did you see it?
No, I didn't see last year's
Okay. I loved it. It's my favorite comedy match of the year. I thought it was great. I've shown it to people. I think it was tremendous. It was the year before. What it was Kenny comes to the ring, and at the time, he's the cleaner. This is before the Tokyo Dome main event. He's starting to get elevated. This is where he wins the G1, but he's not at that level yet, right? And he would still come to the ring with this, like, cleaning spray,
yeah.
You know? And he would, like, spray it. And he comes down to the ring with that thing. He's spraying it all over. And then, you know, he comes down with the Young Bucks. And then they go on to have their match. And the match is all the usual Yano stuff, you know, pulling off the turnbuckles and trying to distract the referee so you can, you know, hit the nut shot. And, you know, he hits the nut shot on Omega, and Omega hits the nut shot on him. And it's like, you know, both of them. And then he pins Omega or Yano after his nut shot. And it's hilarious. And then as soon as the match is over, he goes spread eagle. And the Young Bucks run into the ring and start spraying that cleaning spray all over his crotch. It's hilarious. I never laughed so goddamn hard. And you know, he's grabbing. He's like, no, closer. And he's just telling them to spray his, you know, balls because they're hurting from this. And it's just awesome. And that one was perfect because it was silly, but it never seemed phony. It just seemed like this guy's, like this Yano guy's, this crazy guy who does all this crazy stuff, and like Omega is willing to get crazy too, and is willing to go there with him. And so they had this match that seemed plausible while still being super entertaining and funny.
Yeah.
This year's match lacked that. This year's match definitely made wrestling look fake and phony. This year's match definitely when it's happening, there's absolutely no doubt that that this isn't real, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what it lost in the translation. The spot where their legs are tied together and they're jumping, like he jumps at Yano, or Omega does, at like, you know, 1 mile an hour, if that, and then hits him and he falls like he's being shot. It looks like guys who are working together to have fun.
Yeah.
And that has no place in New Japan going too far, and especially no place in the G1, such a serious tournament. So for me, it's like you could do it, and they did it so perfectly last year, and I recommend you and everybody goes watch this match. It was so great. It's so funny. But they lost it here.
Yeah.
Now, honestly, for me, that did not work.
That's fair. I mean, and I think that's the one thing with matches like these, and or any match, there's going to be stuff that you're going to like that I'm going to be a little like, nah, I don't know. And there's going to be stuff that I'm like, yeah, you know, I enjoyed that. Like, I got a kick out of that. Like, and then there's going to be stuff where it's like, eh. I think, realistically, I think, to me, the G1 format needs to change. I know, the third year this is the current format of it?
The current format, yeah.
Yeah.
It used to be they would have more matches quickly. But they wouldn't have all those tag matches. So, you know, their thinking is, oh, we're giving the guys more of a break because we're spreading it out longer.
Yeah.
But the truth is, because they still work really hard in those tag matches, they're actually just taking a more punishment over a longer period. The thing is, no matter if it's this format or the old format, I mean, I know people say they want to change it and it's really physical. We talk about working safe but hitting hard. But it's tough. Sometimes you have to protect the guys from themselves. Really do. But the guys, if you ask them, they'll say, don't change it. I love it. They're like, I can't wait till it's over when I'm doing it. But then I look back and think that was the most fun I ever had. AJ Styles talks about the G1s as easily his best experience, you know.
Yeah.
So,
and I mean, and that's a big thing. If the guys, you know, sometimes you got to protect the performers from themselves. But if it's something that really, it lights a fire under them and they're enjoying themselves and they're going hard. And I mean, really and truly, this is the last big thing this year for New Japan. It's not, there's some stuff that will pop up over the next couple months, but it's going to really kind of drop off a little bit and build up for the Tokyo Dome show, which
that's significant. And you have to understand again, how New Japan does it. If you're not familiar with it, and you hear about how physical this is and the dangers and blah blah blah, and you see a guy like Disco Inferno who doesn't know his ass from a hat, you know, complaining on Twitter and different places, and
didn't Disco
his podcast with, well, he's an idiot.
Didn't he ask for shots of hot girls at independent shows?
Yes, he did. He asked for shots, and then he said. He took down the tweet and he said, I'm not going to apologize because it was clearly a joke, but I do wish I was more aware of how it would be taken. I'm like, you're an asshole.
Yeah.
Like, and whatever.
Didn't I think there was someone that said he was actually liking and liking pictures that people were sending him?
I think he probably was. I didn't hear that, but it wouldn't surprise me.
And
just whatever. He's useless. He's a moron.
Yeah.
Doesn't it's amazing he's been in wrestling because he doesn't know anything about it. But what was I saying? So we talk about the safe and we talk about how brutal it is and this and that. But yeah, I mean, they do the Tokyo Dome show January 4th every year, no matter what day of the week it is. And then they go around and they go and build towards Dominion. And in between, they have like the junior tournament and they have, you know, the New Japan Cup tournament. And the pace in the schedule isn't as hard. And then they go to the G1 and they do incredible business. And then again, then they kind of rest. Now you'll have World Tag League, you know, you'll have events, things like that, that'll kind of, but the guys will rest their bodies in now and take it easy over the next 4 months until the Tokyo Dome, and then start to build up again.
Yeah.
So it's like, and the guys, it's also goes by tours, that, and so not everybody's booked for every tour. You know, it's not like WWE where you're on TV, if you're on TV or not. You're coming in and you're working house shows and these different things. Like if you're not on the tour, you could be off for a month and getting a break too. So, like, I understand people wanting to make the change because it is definitely a brutal style. And you've seen guys like Misawa and you know, die, you know, young and you know, guys like Kobashi who are all beat up. And you just see these guys. But you see that from North American guys too. And I don't know that over the course of a calendar year, that honest to God, WWE guys don't take more punishment than these guys.
No, that's actually a fair point. You actually think about it. I mean, Scott Dawson, is it Scott Dawson?
Who got the injury here?
Torn
bicep? Yeah.
Yeah, his bicep's torn. And that's just, he's working a house show. And I think the big part that I guess people got to realize is it's wrestling. There's going to be injuries. There's going to be stuff that happens. And, I mean, you look at
always.
It in Japan, like, there's guys that are beat up and they've probably got injuries, but they've got nothing that's really put a lot of guys out, minus Shibata. We'll talk about Shibata in a moment here, but they've done... I like that they have that break at the end of the year and kind of take it easy. Tag teams can kind of carry the workload for the end part of the last couple months. And
exactly.
And the smart thing is, you and me will both be watching the Tokyo Dome show. They've already sold it on us, and we're what? How many months away?
Yeah, exactly. Four months,
like,
you know?
I think we were sold at the start of the G1. So that was about, what, a month and a half ago that the G1 kicked up?
Mm-hmm.
So all the way in June, so 6 months out of the year, we're already sold on a card that we don't have any full idea on who's going to be on it and what position. We kind of have an idea, but we have a better idea now where things are going, but we're already sold on that. We're already going to be tuning in, and that helps these guys long term, because then it gives them a little bit of downtime to heal up and get ready.
Yeah, they don't have to kill themselves to get us hyped for the Tokyo Dome, because we've already bought in. Yeah, that's an excellent point, Joel. You know, certainly Josh could never make a point that good, I must say.
No.
I could.
Yeah, you could, he couldn't.
Yeah.
See, this is fun, because usually I'm on the butt end of all the jokes between you guys, so it's nice that the roles have been reversed.
I got lots of jokes on you I want to make still, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but it's nice that it's changed just a little bit.
Well, he's not here to defend himself. That's why I like to pick on people.
Exactly. That's the time to do it, when the backs turn and they're far away.
That is my style. I am kind of like Toriano. He's my hero.
There you go. That really explains a lot. Every time I see Yano now, I'm going to think of you, Mo.
Oh, good. But
now,
yeah, I mean, again, that's an excellent point that they're going to have. They don't have to kill themselves because that's already sold. And, you know, it's like I said, I really do wonder if the guys, like the amount of actual ring time that bumps that they take over the course of a year is probably less than it is in WWE,
yeah.
Honestly.
Oh, yeah. And I think when you look at it, they take a beating, but it's not as often and as big, unless you're a guy like Okada.
Oh, he's crazy.
Yes. Oh, 100%. He'd be probably the equivalent to working a WWE schedule for New Japan. Just everything he's been through this year. He's been through a lot. Two matches with Suzuki is enough to kill a person.
Oh, yeah, no question.
Question, how did Yano face against Suzuki?
He beat him. And that's like his third time that he's beat him in a G1. Again, it's actually a storyline.
Didn't he tape him up? Wasn't that how he
beat him? Yes, well, last year he beat him by taping him up to the railway on the outside and running back into the ring. This year he beat him because now Suzuki, who, if those people are not aware of Minoru Suzuki, beat like Ken Shamrock in shoot fights back when Ken Shamrock was at his most dangerous, you know, like in the early 90s. Like, he's a legit badass. And
that's like
the
a
character.
Killer.
He seriously looks, he sells that gimmick. He's an awesome worker, but he sells that gimmick. That he's ones, and you watch the match that he had with AJ in G1 like 4 years ago. It's unreal. but yeah, so this character who's like the scariest guy in the whole company, so scary that when Omega on the first night of the tournament had to face him, he wouldn't even look him in the eye. He faces this joke character in Yano, and Yano's beat him for the third year in a row. Like, this time Suzuki decides he's going to take the tape and turn the tables on him and tie him up and then beat the hell out of him. And instead, what happens is he thinks that he's done that. And, of course, Yano ends up getting the tape back, taping him up around his arms this time so that, you know, like, so his arms are tight to his body, and then rolls and then hits the low blow, I believe, or just rolls him up. I can't recall. Yano matches are inventive, and the psychology is not bad. And so now you have this. So you actually have, because again, he's a champion, Minoru Suzuki. He's their open weight championship, which is, you know, it was originally designed for the younger people. But I mean, obviously he's like 48 and he has it now, though he's still incredible in incredible shape. But yeah, it was originally designed for a title that the younger performers could go for. But now it's evolved away from that. But as an open weight title, anybody of any weight class can challenge for it. And so now you have him as the champion from this scary guy. And this guy that he's beat like three times that he just hates. Because this guy, whose nickname, by the way, Yano's nickname, is the Sublime Master Thief. And he's in the same group, Chaos, as like, Okada why am I forgetting the other names?
Rocky.
Osprey. Pardon me?
Rocky Romero.
Rocky Romero, Osprey, Okada. Why am I thinking? Goto is another big name who was in the finals last year against Omega. So he now has a legit reason to face this guy. And I don't know if it's going to be at the Tokyo Dome or if it's going to be before that. But he beat Suzuki, so now he can challenge for this, you know, open neverweight championship. And his gimmick is he's a horrible wrestler who's smarter than you, so he figures out a way to win. And it's a hell of a storyline.
Hey,
you know,
I think, and that's the thing, like, that's the theme with this whole G1 is the storylines. And kind of back to the last two nights, Kenny Omega had two incredible matches back-to-back, and him and Okada, that storyline that they built from the first Tokyo Dome show to now, just all culminated in Omega finally hitting that one-winged angel, which, from my understanding, there's only one person that's ever kicked out of the one-winged angel. Do you know who it is?
No.
It's Ibushi.
That does not surprise me. That's good. That's excellent, actually.
So,
because, nobody kicks out of that. I mean, the two most protected moves in New Japan are that and the Gotch Pile Driver by Suzuki.
Yeah.
Nobody ever kicks out of these moves. Now, in the last match, he hit the one wind angel on Okada, and Okada got his foot on the ropes, but he never kicked out.
Yeah.
This time he got it in the middle of the ring, he hit it, and he didn't kick out. So, you know, and then the whole storyline is that he's trying to hit it against Naito, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, doesn't. So, yeah. awesome. Like, just awesome.
And Kenny and Naito, they had a match last year. It was an all
right. You call him Naito. I just call him Naito. I don't know which is right. But then again, you call him Ishii, and I call him Ishii. I don't know which is right, but probably me.
One or the other, give or take. We'll ask them ourselves when we meet them one day and just see.
Oh, I got to go to the Tokyo Dome, man. I got to get there. I'd love to get to a G1 finals too.
Both of them both are on my wrestling bucket list. I think both would be very much worth going to see.
Even better if I could get them to come here.
Oh God!
So I don't have to get on a plane and shit.
If they came out here, like the Long Beach, I hope is very successful, and I hope it just starts growing, because I'd have no problem, even if I had to go down to the States for a couple days to see them, I'd gladly go down and do it.
Well, again, this is a company whose business is growing and growing and growing, and it's growing in Japan and it's growing worldwide. And then you have WWE, a company whose business is not growing. And yeah, the gap is massive. But I don't think it's impossible to foresee New Japan Pro Wrestling with their slogan, Strong Style Evolved, kind of, especially if they get someone like Daniel Bryan, you know?
Did you hear the podcast between him and Edge and Christian?
I did not, but I mean, I know it's possible either way. Like, I know it's, you know, it's very possible.
He had some interesting thing. It's worth checking out. But Omega and Naito have an incredible match, and we know who's going to the Tokyo Dome, or at least we think, unless he loses that contract. But Naito,
which he has to defend against people who beat him.
So Naito's going. I don't see him losing. I really see this as the redemption story from his past, where he didn't get to main event the Tokyo Dome because the fans voted him out. And
yeah, let's go into that in just a little more detail again for those people who are not aware. And again, we're talking about good storylines. So here's a shoot thing. Many years ago, Naito, we talked about Tanahashi. He's there like John Cena. And Naito was essentially Tanahashi Light. He was, you know, a little bit younger, you know, similar wrestling style, similar look. He had similar hair at the time. Very, very similar. And he was pushed much in that way, and they wanted to push him to the main event level. So he won the G1. He won his block only going 5-4 and winning the tiebreakers to go. And then he won in the final and beating Tanahashi, actually. And so he ends up getting the briefcase. And it's Okada's first year as champion. And Okada had been a guy who was, you know, a young boy, goes on an excursion to TNA. TNA are morons and treat him like he's literally, you know, what's his name from the Green Hornet?
Kane?
Yeah, whatever. The Green Hornet sidekick, Kato. Thank you. Literally make him Kato to Samoa Joe. Like, literally. just horrible, you know. So anyways, but he's Japanese, so they figure there's no money in him. So they bring him back now, and he gets pushed to this spot. He's not that over. He's not over as a main eventer yet. So Okada's not over as a main eventer. And then you have this new guy who's won the G1 who's finally getting his first push. So they're scheduled to meet in the Tokyo Dome. Meanwhile, the Intercontinental title is Nakamura, who's holding it, has made that title almost as valuable as the world title. And Tanahashi's the guy who's challenging for it. So now you have, like, these legends in this supposedly second match, and the ticket sales aren't that great. And so New Japan, this wasn't the plan, but they literally go out there and ask the fans, what match do you want to go on last? What match do you want to main event? And of course, by a landslide, the Intercontinental title match between Nakamura and Tanahashi wins. So Okada has since gone on to main event the Tokyo Dome multiple times. Naito never has. He goes to CMLL on excursion, and he joins over there their top heel group, Los Ingobernables.
I'm glad you can pronounce it.
Yeah, I try my best. Can't say it as well as Naito. And he goes over there, and he comes back. And the gimmick is that he's seen the racism, and he's seen the company for what they are, and he's seen the racism in Mexico, and he sees the world for what it is now. Now he's a surly heel character. And he develops this his own group, Los Ingobernables de Japón, you know. And this thing takes off like you can't believe. Even though it's supposed to be a heel, they're selling shirts. And even though he's getting booed at first, to the point where now, even though he still acts heelish and still tries to be a heel, he's starting to give up on it because he has become the most popular guy in New Japan. He is more popular than Omega. He's more popular than Okada. He's more popular than Tom. They sell the most merchandise. He is easily the most popular guy. When he comes to the ring, the crowd just chants his name. And he connects them. He had his chance. And through nothing that he had done wrong, he got screwed out of that title match. And he went away. And then came back, and he's anti-authority, and he's got some of that Stone Cold thing.
Yeah.
You know? And they relate to him. They relate to this guy who did get screwed but didn't give up. And they relate to this guy who decided he wasn't going to live by anybody else's rules. Now he's going to set his own. And it's his time. He is the most popular guy, and not only should he go to the Tokyo Dome, he should beat Okada for that title. He had it once last year, beating Okada. But he had a lot of outside interference, and he only had it for like 6 weeks. He needs a real serious run with it. He's not quite as good a wrestler as Okada, but he's not far behind. You know, he's on the same level. And his charisma is unbelievable.
And the
character is unbelievable.
And that's the thing that I think draws, like, that whole group has a lot of really good character work. Naito, between what he did to the title, When asked what he'd do if he won the U.S. Championship, I'll throw it on the water. Just small little things like that. When he grabbed the G1 trophy and made it look like he was going to throw it, and the crowd gasped. And
well, when he was Intercontinental Champion for a long time, he would literally throw it, and you know there'd be videos of him running over it with his car, and it was beat the shit.
Yeah.
Because he was not going to give these guys, you know. And when if he won the U.S. title that Omega won in Long Beach. That he was said, yeah, there's too many titles. This one should be meaningless. Like, it's meaningless because there's too many, so I'm just going to throw it away anyways. Like, all this, though, resonated with the fans. And they're like, yeah, you know, we want to say fuck you to people, too, who screw us over. And you're doing that.
And, I mean, like, you look at, I remember when he beat Okada for the title, and he threw it up in the air, and he stepped on it, and And I knew how prestigious that title was when he had won it at that point.
Nobody does that to that title.
Yeah. And the fact that he did that got such a big reaction. And what he did to the Intercontinental title, a title that was built up by Nakamura, now will look like, this is your Intercontinental title? And that whole storyline, that added another storyline to the Tanahashi. And honestly, I hope he wins at Wrestle Kingdom, and I hope to see him throw that title in the air and just continue to not give a fuck.
Yeah, he can't change the character. He can't change what made people love him.
And,
but he's softening it a little bit. You can soften it slightly. Like, that's what happened with Stone Cold. And Austin softened it slightly when he turned babyface.
Yeah.
Not a lot, though. Not too much. Just a little bit. Just a little bit. So that he wasn't a total heel anymore. And that's what you can do here. But not too much.
Yeah.
But I agree. It's his time, man. Yeah. And it's an incredible storyline. It's like 4 years, 5 years ago? Five years ago, I think now. 5 years ago to get back here and in this situation. Like, it's just amazing.
Yeah. And, I mean, you talk about cream rising to the top. He's doing that. He's rising to the top. And it's his time to take it. And, I mean, as much of a year as Okada has, he's got to lose at some point. And sadly, it's not to Evil, but I think it's to Naito. And I think it just builds.
Same group, though.
Yeah.
You know, Naito was brought into Los Ingobernables by Naito when he first came back. So
can I just say Daryl is one of my favorite non-.
Oh, so great.
Oh, and you saw what happened in the UK tour?
Bad luck, Fale, but then the fist bump at the end. Oh, so great.
Oh, yeah. And you saw what the Bucks did to Daryl.
No, I didn't.
No, you probably found the video on Twitter, but they did a Meltzer driver to Daryl.
Oh, that's so great.
So it's just little things like that. And Takahashi has quickly become one of my favorite people to just see what they're doing. Because when he's with Daryl, it's great, it's funny, it's silly. It's the epitome to me of what pro wrestling is. It's something that's out there, but it's just like this I love this. This is perfect.
There's enough entertainment, but it's not stupid.
Yeah.
It's not like Fashion Police, which has gotten stupid. Started off good, and now has gotten stupid.
I disagree with you, but
it's gotten stupid.
We'll leave that stone alone for a little bit. Naito, happy for him, happy to see that Daryl has been able to be put back together. But I think one of the biggest moments, and I think this is the best way to close the podcast off, besides picking our G1 match that happened over the course of many, many matches, was Shibata leaving a group of grown adults in tears,
taking the women, but
in the ring, and then saying, "I'm alive. That is all." That,
yeah.
I don't know about you, but that moment, like, chills seeing that, because I heard.
Oh yeah, here's how it went for me. Okay, go ahead. How it was for you, actually.
So what it was I missed it because I went straight in to watch the final match because I didn't watch it live. And then I saw on Twitter that Shibata...
So it's at 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah. So I go and find the Bucks match because I find out that's where it is. And I watch the whole moment with Kevin Kelly calling it. And then I watch the Japanese version of it as well. And I'm just like, holy crap, goosebumps all the way through. Because this is a guy that it was reported, and for those who don't know, he'd finished a 5-star match against Okada, left the ring, collapsed, crawled in the back for a bit, finally got medical help. One side of his body was paralyzed, and he was losing eyesight in one of his eyes.
I just want to make an addition. It wasn't just that he had this match, his 5-star match, late in the match, and this is already an incredible match. He does a shoot headbutt, which is a spot that I haven't seen, I don't think, since. But you see occasionally, not a lot, but you see occasionally, and they shouldn't do it, but you see it occasionally, like I would see Makabe versus Ishii do it, you know? But he does that, and as soon as he hit it, there's still a worked way to do it that's not so dangerous, but he missed, and I can't believe Okada was okay. He hit him, and you hear the sound. It's like this sick thud. Like, you'll never forget the sound.
Yeah.
Like, boom. And then you see the camera cut to him, and he hasn't had time to blade or do anything. And just like one trickle of blood just going down the straight of his face, right down to his nose, and he looks out of it.
Yeah.
But he also looks like he wants to kill. And he somehow goes on and finishes the match with seemingly no issues.
Yeah.
Like, you would have thought, oh, okay, that was somehow set up. And like, the match was flawless from there still.
Yeah.
You know?
And just to think, like, there was a point where it just seemed very not good for Shibata. And he wasn't able to leave the back.
Yeah, what was it they say? It was a blood clot that had formed due to this headbutt?
Yeah, I think it was a blood clot, or there was some hemorrhaging.
In his cranium.
Yeah, and he had to have like part of his skull kind of removed to relieve the pressure. It was very just not good. And he's walking down to the ring, and he takes a bump. He does a back bump.
You mean when he came out? I'm just going to... So, I was on vacation, because, taking some time off. And I was having trouble sleeping that night. And I get, like, push notifications from New Japan World when there's an event on. And usually, I watch it in the morning, or the next day after work, or whatever. And so, I'm sitting there, and I got it. I can't sleep. I look over at my phone. I'm like... I ignore it. I try and go back to sleep for a long time. I can't sleep. Too damn hot. Whatever. I'm like, shit. I think maybe I'll just check out and see what's going on. I'm like, I know it's the last night. Literally, it's the end of the Bucks Taguchi Ricochet match. And man, was that ever a great match.
Oh,
what
yeah.
Great psychology for those of you who think the Bucks can't do it. Great psychology. And great selling from Ricochet. But so I'm watching it. And I hear the music. And I'm like, I think it's Suzuka's music at first. It's kind of got that soft opening. I'm not really paying attention because I'm not thinking about it. And I'm tired. I just can't sleep. And then I think it's Kevin Kelly who goes, that's Shibata's music. Because they don't know either. Like, the announcers didn't know this. Nobody knew this was coming. And the crowd is starting to just, like, this reaction that you can't believe. And yeah, he just, he looks pretty good. A little skinnier.
Yeah.
A little skinnier, you know, but he just walks through the ring and you're like, what is going on? Of course, he talks in Japanese, so we don't find out what he says till the next morning. Nobody clues us in. But yeah, like you say, he comes to the ring, does that flat butt bump. And then he just sits there cross-legged, which was one of his moves, to go cross-legged. And like one of his things, that he would get in the ring and just tell you to hit himself. Like he was a strong-style wrestler. In fact, his nickname was The Wrestler. Like his gimmick was, he could just take more punishment than you.
Yeah.
Like he was just tougher than you, was really his gimmick. No frills, much like a Benoit type guy, right? That type of thing. Like no frills, just hit me and I'm going to keep coming. I won't quit type of gimmick. And so he would have this thing where he would just sit cross-legged in the middle of the ring and either challenge you to come in or have you come in and just hit him. And he would just absorb your punishment and then fire back on you. So he does that, and they cut to him, and there's a close-up, and you can just see the emotion on his face.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're cutting to the crowd, and you see the emotion there, and you just see. And then, yeah, he gets up, he says something, it's two words, and then Kevin Kelly's like, man, a few words. You don't know what he says, but it got a massive reaction. So when I found out that what got a massive reaction was, I am alive, that is all. And then he left. But it was just such a moment, because you literally, and his career probably is over. He'll probably do some training in the dojo. It doesn't mean he's likely to come back and wrestle again, but you just didn't even know if you'd see him.
Yeah.
In fact, it was really scary. And like I say, that's of all the things that happened in New Japan this year, that's the best moment.
Yeah, and like we had talked off air a little bit about the moments in wrestling that really is really a defining thing for pro wrestling. That's a moment. That's something that you can look back and you know that story. And I actually did some research on Shibata's story, on his path with New Japan, on how he left, and then he came back, and he had to earn his way back. And I'd always heard a rumor, I don't know if it was confirmed or not, but there was always that rumor that he was supposed to eventually beat Okada this year for the title. He was supposed to take the title for a little bit. And
he was certainly, and after that match, his popularity and the momentum he had coming out of that match, the losing after really taking it to Okada, I think people really wanted to see it, maybe even more than Naito, you know?
Yeah.
He might have. Like, what role would he have played in the Tokyo Dome? What role would he have played in the New Japan Cup? For years, he's been that guy who never got his shot. For years. Like, at least Naito got his shot, you know? Got screwed somewhat, but at least he got his shot. And Shibata never even got that. There was definitely... He was, much like Daniel Bryan, when Daniel Bryan, the injuries curtailed his career, he was just getting to the point where he could now sow the rewards of his hard work. And we would see him in that position as the top guy. And we never got to see it. Like it was, you know, cut short and, you know, the injury, you know, bad feud with Kane, injury comes back, IC title, it's gone, you know, you never saw it. He had worked so hard, and we were on that journey with him. He got there. We wanted to now, we almost wanted to relax and just say, good for you. Just be on top now. And Shibata's that same thing where he's just like, you know, he finally got there. He's like, if it wasn't now, it was sometime in the next year. He was going to be champion. It was inevitable. He, everything that he worked so hard and sacrificed for, and now, very similar.
Yeah, and it's a shame, but... Man, am I glad to see that he's walking and alive. I think that's the biggest thing that you can take from it.
For sure.
Is he's able to more or less have a normal life outside of wrestling. And we all know what his goal is. And it's the same goal Brian has. It's
of course. That. Same goal Hanma, who's another guy who was paralyzed in Japan from a DDT wrong earlier this year, has. You know, same goal. Yeah, most people have.
Yeah. They'll be back and... I don't know if I want to see Shibata back in a ring. I don't know how comfortable I'll be. No. But if he can come back safely, then...
With that style he has, I don't know.
Yeah, and that's the biggest thing. Like, we've learned that you definitely have to check out the Brian podcast with Edge and Christian. But
yeah, I probably would have. I check them, like, once every month or so, just see what's been on and then binge listen to the ones I want to listen to. So
yeah.
I'll definitely check that out.
Because basically what Brian said was he got word, lesion on the brain, retires. But actually, in medical terms, a lesion can mean anything. It's just something that they don't quite recognize on a scan. To Brian, a lesion means a cut on the brain. doesn't mean that medically. In medical terms, it just means that there's some anomaly on a CT scan or something. So he doesn't actually have a cut on his brain. And what he's been doing is a hyperbolic oxygen chamber that if he does 120 sessions, I believe he said, he could potentially get his brain back to that of a... it basically be a brain similar to a college football player. He'd have a brain of college football player.
Which isn't great.
No.
I mean, the studies of that are still scary, too.
Yeah. And the other thing that he pointed out was this test that said that he couldn't return, they said that the test that WWE sent him to do was a little flawed, because what the test does is it takes a baseline, and then after you have a concussion, they test you a second time, and until you return to that baseline, then you're safe to return. But until you return to your baseline, they didn't have a baseline for Brian. And the problem, the red flag that they had for Brian was that his reflexes were a little bit slower than what they would consider for a football player or an MMA fighter. So basically, his reflexes were average and they didn't match up. So that's kind of some of the backstory. You definitely listen to the podcast because it definitely goes more in depth than I did, but it's very interesting to listen to and definitely kind of shed some light on the situation with Brian. And as Brian says, there's still research every day on concussions. We don't have a lot of knowledge on it, but it's something that is very important to learn more about. And the other thing that Brian really drives home is he's like, I want to wrestle again. But if a doctor pulls me to the side and say, and shows me scientifically that if I get in the ring, I won't be able to take care of my daughter, it won't be good for me, then it's done and over with for me. It's simple as that. But until a doctor 100%, because he got cleared by 3 to 4 doctors, all concussion specialists. So it's one of those things now where we may see Brian in 2018, we might not, but it's really going to depend on how his next set of rounds for this hyperbolic chamber and what further doctors say.
I'll say this, I know that Brie, who was against him wrestling, now seems to be okay with the thought of it. If everything is right, so that's a big deal. So that if she's okay with it, certainly I shouldn't probably be worried. But
yeah,
admittedly, I'd just rather never see him take the chance. I'd rather never see Shibata. I all these guys, I'd rather go, you know, your life is bigger and your potential is bigger than just wrestling.
Yeah.
You're so much more you can be and do. So.
Oh, yeah.
I think Daniel, I'm not kidding, I think Daniel Bryan could be president. Like, you think he has that kind of charisma and ability to relate to people and genuineness and intelligence, though intelligence apparently is not necessary to be president.
No.
But well, I'm just going on current evidence. But but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I think like his potential is that great. Like he can do a lot. So beyond just wrestling. Someday he'll realize that.
Oh yeah. And, I mean, I think he could be a huge, if he does leave and if he does take the ROH New Japan route, he'd be huge for their penetrating the North American market, because that's a name that you could, that Bryan Danielson, the Yes Man, is here.
He could literally be a game changer and be the first guy to make wrestling truly competitive again. In a long, 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 long time.
And it will make Vince's blood boil.
Well.
Maybe that'll light a fire under the old man.
I don't know.
I've heard little rumors that Vince just doesn't care anymore. He's made his money. Doesn't matter to him. He's just going to do what he wants.
Well, that's pretty obvious.
Yeah. But
I think he cares. I mean, I don't think he can turn that off, personally.
Yeah. And how obsessed he is about stuff, I don't know. But, you know, I think that's kind of hit the tail end of everything for us. Is there anything you'd like to add on the G1?
Jeez, there's so much. If I was to say, anything to somebody who's listening, you can go in at any time and watch a great match, but it's tough because we talk about the storylines and that there's more to the matches. The more you watch, the more you get out of it. And it's entertaining, but not in the way that WWE is.
Yeah.
It's just as entertaining, but in a totally different way. But you have to, I think, to get that entertainment, you have to invest more to get the entertainment out of it than you do in WWE. But I would definitely recommend to people do that. But if nothing else, just go and check out, just go Google a list of the G1, you know, the best matches or highlights, and go check out some of the stuff. And you'll see wrestling can be different, and it's nice for it to feel important.
Yes. I guess the only thing I got to add on that is New Japan World is a treasure. I think that's just going to continue to grow. I'm very patiently waiting for them to come out with an Apple TV app for it. Because
yeah.
The minute they come out with a North American app for it, I think that, again, changes the game for them. It's the best.
They absolutely have to do that. I mean, yeah, it's something that they're lacking is being on Apple and Xbox and PS4 and these things. That's still a place they need to get to, though. There's lots of ways to watch, you know, on your computer or phone or whatever.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's definitely something. But, yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I enjoyed it. This was the first G1 I really watched in depth, and it was well worth it. I didn't feel like it was taking up my time. I felt like I was investing my time in it. And as a wrestling fan, I got a lot out of it, and I really enjoyed it. And I'm really, really excited to see what they do at the Tokyo Dome. I have no, like, there's stuff that you can nitpick on it and go through, but at the end of the day, it was one of the better forms of pro wrestling I've seen in a long time, and I hope New Japan continues to have the success that it's had.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, and I think they will. Like I said, I think that it's not going to be overnight, but I think that the gap is going to continue to close, and I'm not one of these guys who thinks WWE is guaranteed to always be in business just because they're WWE. They have to provide the right stuff. They have to not make mistakes like they've done with Jinder Mahal and, you know, and things like that.
But I completely agree. And I think I'll be back for next year's G1 and just continue to enjoy the joy that New Japan brings just from a wrestling standpoint. So for Mo, this is Joel and no Josh here. So we're able to talk a lot about Japan, and I was able to get a word in this podcast. It feels great.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, you got a word in, but,
yeah.
More importantly, nothing really stupid was said.
And that's always a good thing for podcasts. So thanks again for coming on, Mo. And anytime you want to talk about New Japan, I'm more than game for it. And
hey, we got to definitely check in and talk New Japan during the big moments for sure.
Yes, absolutely. So I can't do the big sign-off like Josh does, but just make sure you follow us, check out all our old podcasts, and we'll just keep cranking these wrestling podcasts out. So enjoy!